So, we left the Pandavas in the forest. Things have come, in a sense, full circle for them. They grew up high in the mountains, living a very, very, very simple life as young sages, yogis. And now, after enjoying all the opulences of a kingdom and even of an empire, they're back, in a sense, superficially where they started from. They're back in the forest living very simply. And the Pandavas, compared to other major figures in the Mahabharata, they're the ones who are actually able to do this without losing their dharma cool, you could say. Because they, I mean, think of Karna. When Karna felt frustrated because there were no opportunities for him, let's say, to work at his level, to find a profession according to his actual abilities, he responded by lying to an avatar, Parashuram, and then for no good reason ever given in the Mahabharata, becoming the self-declared enemy of good people, namely the Pandavas. And Duryodhana, when Duryodhana or Dhritarashtra face the prospect of not losing everything, but even losing something, they respond by sort of this tiring series of attempts at assassination, stealing, usurping. The Pandavas, on the other hand, going from riches to rags, you could say, literally, after having performed the Rajasuya sacrifice and having this most flourishing, happy kingdom, suddenly they're in the forest, and the forest is the forest. This is, of course, very ancient times, and you just can't just stop at, you know, a hotel, or no hotels, no convenience stores, no nothing. It's really the forest. And so, the forest book, so what happens out there in the forest during all these years? For one thing, this is the main opportunity in the Mahabharata to tell all kinds of other stories. You know, they obviously have a lot of time on their hands. And and many great sages would go to meet them there. Vyasa, of course, went several times. Krishna himself met them there several times. So many, all these great personalities went to visit the Pandavas in the forest. And when the sages came to see them and to encourage them, like, don't give up hope, they would often tell them stories. And so a good part of the Mahabharata is a series of stories about other places, other times, other kings, but stories which are somehow relevant to the Pandavas. And perhaps the most famous one, which I'll just tell you very briefly, is the story of, just giving an example, just give you a very brief summary of it, Nala and Damayanti. In fact, many years ago, actually, maybe 100 years ago, or 80 or 90 years ago, I forget the date, but Harvard Oriental series, they published a reader, a Sanskrit reader, called Landman's Reader, Professor Landman, and many generations of Sanskrit students have read from that reader. And it begins, the first story, of course, is, or the main story is Nala and Damayanti, it begins, Asid Raja Nala Nama, that there was a king named Nala. So that's the Sanskrit student for many generations all knew that line. So anyway, this story was told to Yudhisthira because of his disastrous experience in gambling. And so Nala was also a great king who had lost everything in gambling. In fact, you know the story, don't you, Shankara? So I may have to ask you for a detail or two. But in fact, he lost everything to the point where all he had left was a single piece of cloth for himself and his queen. Isn't it? And so they had to go out to the forest, the king and the queen wrapped in the same cloth. That's all they had. And they were out in the forest. Now, I'll just be very brief about this. And so Nala decided that somehow his wife would not survive in the forest, and he had to force her to take shelter with her family. And so he left her in the middle of the night, isn't it? He left her, and so she woke up, and there she is, and her husband's gone. And she's out in the forest, and so she did take shelter with some of her relatives. And so she, again, is living as a queen. Meanwhile, Nala has all these travails, and he ends up serving a king after many adventures and misadventures. And his wife, of course, I mean, this is a very romantic couple. This is one of the great romantic stories of the Mahabharata. So his wife, determined to find him to get him back, because he's very ashamed and completely his spirit has been broken. And so, meanwhile, he's learned to gamble, so he's not going to have the same kind of problem he had in the first place, because he's learned to gamble. And so, I think, in fact, he serves the king as a gambling teacher. And
driving his chariot.
And driving his chariot, yeah, I guess both. What's that?
Chariot that can fly.
So the queen, so the Damayanti, in order to find her husband, with whom she was still very much in love, she declared, she had a notice sent out all over the world that she's going to have a swayam bar to choose a new husband. And of course she was very attractive, and actually she didn't have a message sent all over the world, she just had it sent to the place where he was. And so the king that he was serving thought, wow, Damayanti. And so he had Nala drive him on the chariot to that kingdom. But when they arrived there at the city, there were no preparations for a Swayamvara. When Swayamvaras are held, you know, the whole city becomes a big festival site. And so he got there and there's nothing. And no one even knows about it. And then it turns out, of course, that there is no Swayamvara. It was simply a trick to get him to come. And then they're united, isn't it? I mean, that's a very brief version of the story. In any case, Yudhisthira hears a story. Who told Yudhisthira the story? Don't remember. One sage tells him the story to encourage him, and then Yudhisthira does actually learn the art of gambling. So in the future, when he's challenged, it won't be a disaster like it was the last time. Anyway, so that happens in the forest. Other significant events that take place in the forest. Arjuna goes to Swarga. Arjuna goes to heaven, the king, the world of Indra, the administrative head of the gods. Because Indra is actually his father, he goes up there and gets celestial weapons. Because there's a very good possibility that there's going to be a world war. The Pandavas don't really expect Duryodhana to hand back the kingdom when the time is up. And so Arjuna goes there and collects all these amazing celestial weapons. And there are very beautiful scenes where his brothers and Kunti, by the way, is no longer with them. She stays behind in Hastinapur under the care of Vidura. She's gotten older, and so it's just the Pandavas and Draupadi. So the other Pandavas and Draupadi go up into the Himalayan mountains, because up way up in the mountains there's a gateway, Swarga Dwara. There's actually a gateway to heaven. There's all kinds of adventures there with Bhima. And so, anyway, it's a time of all kinds of adventures, stories, and so on. But in terms of the main story, at a certain point, Duryodhana, he who has the spies everywhere, Duryodhana receives information that the Pandavas are in a particular forest. Was it Dvaitavan at that point? Where Duryodhana went?
When you come to Kamdastok.
No, that's later. Anyway, because Duryodhana wanted to humiliate them.
Yeah.
And so he heard that the Pandavas were... This is, of course, in the first part of their exile, they don't have to be in hiding. And so Duryodhana went there to the forest and gets himself captured by a Gandharva king. By the way, the story I told you before where the Pandavas are walking along the Ganges and they meet this Gandharva who forbids them to go in the water, and Arjuna says, no way. We are going in the water, and so the Gandharva attacks. Arjuna knocks him literally unconscious, burns up his chariot. And it's very interesting. Actually, Arjuna was carrying a torch. It was getting toward the evening, and when the Gandharva first attacked, Arjuna, simply with his torch, was knocking down all the weapons. Very good fighter. And anyway, so it's the same Gandharva king who now arrests Duryodhana. Duryodhana loses a fight with this Gandharva. The Pandavas are there at arrive at the scene because Duryodhana was looking for them to humiliate them. And so, out of gratitude to Arjuna, who once spared his life, the Gandharva now releases Duryodhana. And Duryodhana this is too much. Just like Arjuna, he's an asura. And the asuras aren't just, I mean, they actually do have character problems. So Duryodhana, who could not stand to see Arjuna's or the Pandavas' opulence and success at the Rajasuya sacrifice, now is absolutely devastated that Arjuna, of all people, has saved his life. So, no gratitude, no remorse, nothing like, well, maybe I shouldn't have been trying to kill this person, you know, so many times. Maybe he's not a bad guy, maybe we can actually work this out. No. Duryodhana is a sworn asura. So he decides that he's basically going to commit suicide. He cannot live on the earth having been saved by Arjuna, having been, this is like too much. So he goes into what is called prayabhavasa, which means that you sit down and fast until death. This is I think this is what Drona does at one point. This was a technique which was sometimes employed, sort of the yoga way to leave the world if you just can't stand it anymore, in which you you just sit down and fast, sit down like in a yoga pose and just fix your mind and fast until you die. And that's what Duryodhana decides to do. Now, a very interesting thing happens. I find the story very interesting. The asuras. Some of the asuras who are not actually on the earth but are kind of like monitoring, sort of like command central. They're monitoring this whole invasion of the earth. They somehow mystically bring Duryodhana there. At least they bring his mind there. They bring him there. And they give him a pep talk. They say, like, what are you doing? Have you forgotten the mission? You know, we've got something to do here on the earth. You can't kill yourself like this. And they remind him of the asura mission. And then he goes back and decides he'll live. He'll keep trying. And this is after all his friends, like Karna and all his brothers, had failed to convince him to stay in the world. But now, after this pep talk, after this, you know, sort of little therapy from other asuras, that he decides to stay in the world. So that happens. Anyway, so the years in the forest pass. As I said, great sages visit them. Krishna often visits them. And there are many other stories told. And finally, the time is up and they have to go incognito. And so they have, of course, a long discussion on where to go. They've been thinking about this. Where is the most strategic place to go? And they decide to go to the kingdom of Virat, which, as far as what scholars say nowadays, is in Rajasthan. And if you know where Jaipur is, it's just not too far from Jaipur to the northeast. To the northeast of Jaipur. Anyway, they went to this kingdom of Virat. Virat also had been a friend of theirs, an ally. Of course, they went incognito, and they all disguised themselves in different ways. Yudhisthira became a counselor to the king, like a Brahmin counselor to the king, and a gambling coach, since he now mastered this art. Bhima got hired in the royal kitchen. And, you know, if you think about it practically, they couldn't have all showed up at the same time because the world knew about this. The world knew the Pandavas had been banished to the forest. They'd spent 1 year incognito. And everybody knew about this. So suddenly, you know, five big guys and a lady show up. It would have been obvious it's them. And so, without going into all the details, which are not given in the text, but they must have intelligently done this. They didn't all show up at the same time. But anyway, Yudhisthira became an advisor to the king. Bhima worked in the kitchen. Arjuna, and this is the most interesting case, Arjuna became a very effeminate girls' dance teacher. And this is not a surprise, a Hindu story, that he was cursed in heaven that he would have to spend 1 year as a eunuch, literally without his male anatomy. And so that's one story. But in any case, he became, I'm not entirely convinced by that little story, but in any case, he did become a very, took the part of a very effeminate, here's Arjuna, very effeminate girl's dance teacher. And obviously, he had to be extremely feminine, if not a eunuch, because otherwise the king would not entrust him to his own daughter and all these other royal girls. So he was, you know, very effeminate. In fact, he would dress in a skirt and he had long braided hair. And I don't know if he talked with a lisp. So this was Arjuna. And then Nakula took care of the horses, and Sahadeva the cows. And they spent a year incognito. And so what happened? The main thing that happened, they did successfully maintain their identities. Draupadi presented herself as Sai Randri, and she was hired as sort of the queen's beautician. And so they were living like this, but again, the problem was Draupadi's beauty. She had a particular beauty which somehow provoked asuras. Now it turned out that the king's brother-in-law, it was the brother of the queen. The queen's brother-in-law was in fact an asura, and his name was Kichika. Kichika. Now Mr. Kichika was in charge of the military forces of Urad, and it was actually because of him, even though he was quite demonic, it was because of him that Urad enjoyed a certain level of sovereignty, even vis-a-vis the Kurus, because of this very powerful commander. So Kichika became quite attracted, to say the least, to Draupadi. And he was a jerk in the sense that, you know, he felt, I'm in this high position, she's just a serving woman, therefore I can do anything I want with her. It was that consciousness. So he made proposals to Draupadi, which of course only disgusted her. And then he decided, you know, he would have her by force. And basically, Draupadi was of course becoming extremely concerned about this, and so she went to her husbands and spoke to them secretly, and the arrangement was that Bhima would take care of it. So they decided that Draupadi would tell Kichika that she had finally succumbed to all of his attractive features, and that she agreed she would in fact submit to him, and they made an arrangement that in the dancing hall, there was a couch in the dancing hall, and that they would meet at night in the dancing hall when of course no one was there. So not Draupadi, but Bhima went there. And there's this, I think, which was intended to be and is a very hilarious scene, where Kichika goes there and, you know, spewing all this pseudo love poetry. And I suppose he had flowers, we had a little box of chocolates or something, but... And of course, you know, he spent quite a bit of time with his own hairdresser that day. So Kichika goes up to the couch, and he's, again, all this, you know, all these romantic words, and actually starts to caress, you know, Bhima. So Bhima just, who's, you know, under this little blanket, or a big blanket, Bhima springs up, and Kichika realizes that this is not Draupadi. So a fight ensues, and Bhima really, really doesn't like Kichika. So Bhima, not only, the way he kills him is kind of, Bhima sort of has a flair for creative killings of demons. And just like with the Rakshasa bucket, he broke him backwards. So in this case, Kichika basically pounds him into a medicine ball. He beats him so badly that he literally pounds his head and into his body. Sorry to tell you this before breakfast, but... and pounds his arms and legs, so literally all that's left is just this ball of flesh. And again, this Kichika was extremely powerful, so when people discover the body in the morning, they are, well... Now, interestingly, because as a news spread that Kichika is dead, Duryodhana, who had no idea the Pandavas were there, decided this is a great opportunity. Because without Kichika, we can easily smash the kingdom of Iran and subjugate them. So Duryodhana sees this as a wonderful political and military military opportunity. So he calls, you know, all his generals, Bhishma, Drona, and Karna, and they're all going to go out to Virat and sort of have an easy takeover and take over this kingdom. So it turns out, though, that by this time, the arrival of Duryodhana to smash and subjugate this free state of Virata, his arrival coincides with the expiry, the end of that 1 year in which the Pandavas have to be incognito. When the Pandavas first entered the city of Virat, they took all their weapons, which were very dear to them. In fact, Arjuna has an extremely famous bow, Gandiva, which is, of course, mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, that it's one of the most dramatic moments of the Gita in the first chapter, when Arjuna is so overcome by lamentation that he actually Gandivam sansate astad. He said the Gandiva is slipping from my hand. So this was famous all over the world, the Gandiva bow, which was actually given to Arjuna by Agni, when Agni gave this bow to Arjuna. Anyway, so when the Pandavas entered Virat, they had to hide their weapons, which was one of the hardest parts for them. They had to hide their weapons. And so they found this tree, and it was a Shami tree. They found a tree which was just by a cremation grounds. And so according to all the superstitions and omens and rules and everything, this is an extremely inauspicious place. Some place that no one would ever go. No one would ever want to get near this tree. And so I think it was Sahadeva. Nakula climbed up in the tree and put the weapons high up in this giant tree. So now that the Kurus are attacking, and the year is ending. So Arjuna says to the prince, Virat's son is Uttara, and his daughter is Uttara, who has fallen in love with Arjuna, and Arjuna's, not yet, no, she hasn't, well, he's her dancing teacher. She didn't fall in love with the feminine dancing teacher, but she's very attached to her or him or it or whatever the dancing teacher is. Anyway, so the prince is Uttara. And he starts bragging. He's this young, swaggering prince that's probably never been in a battle in his life. And, you know, and just has all this sort of warrior hyperbole on his lips. And he's saying, oh, the Kurus are attacking. I can defeat all of them. They're nothing compared to me. And so then Arjuna says, okay, let's go. Let's go defend the kingdom. And when Uttara realizes, and so Uttara starts to think, well, I didn't really mean it. I was just talking. And then, so Arjuna, Brihadnala was his the name he took. He sort of drags the prince in the chariot, and they go to this tree, and Arjuna gets back his weapons. And there's this great scene where Arjuna, after 1 year, finally has Gandiva in his hands again. And at that point, he strings Gandiva. And there's all these, you have to imagine, this is, according to the Mahabharata and all these literatures, back in ancient times, many, many thousands of years ago, there was actually a different and superior technology available to people because of their intercourse, because of their contact with higher worlds, other planets. There was sort of like a technology which was not metallic. It was not type of industrial technology like the big Star Wars ship that goes overhead for 35 minutes. It's not this industrial, metallic, machine-driven technology. It's actually based on yoga and manipulating the elements, the great elements of the universe, like earth, water, fire, and so on, and chanting mantras, and so on. Anyway, so Arjuna gets down these weapons, and there's always like these pulsating, glowing weapons, and Uttara is astonished, he's never seen weapons like this in his life. And of course, he doesn't know that these are the weapons of the Pandavas. Anyway, Arjuna takes his bow, and the Kurus are attacking. The Kurus are actually starting to attack. Because what happened is, this is a typical military strategy. I mean, Alexander used this. And that is, they sent some soldiers off to one side and drew all the Virag's forces that way, and then meanwhile, the main attack came straight for the city, and there was hardly anyone left there, and that's why Arjuna and Ut, you know, had to take the matter in his own hands. Anyway, so the Kurus are attacking, and when Arjuna strings his bow and, like, twangs his bow, it emits this powerful sound, and it's like, even the Kurus hear it, and as soon as they hear that sound, they're like stunned, and because all the warriors actually know that sound. They know it's the sound of Arjuna's bow. And that causes some confusion among them. Anyway, then and Arjuna, by the way, is still in his dress. And with his long braids. And so and he's driving the chariot. So he takes all these weapons and he tells... and he starts driving towards the Kurus. Now, Ujjara, when he actually sees all these great Kuru warriors, Karna, Bhishma, Drona, and even Duryodhana, he actually sees them. He, I would say he almost had an accident in his pants. I mean, when he actually sees all these great warriors, he's like... Anyway, he's extremely frightened, and he tells Arjuna, "Get me out of here, get me out." And Arjuna keeps driving straight for the Kurus. And Uttara is just, you know, in panic. He's like screaming in utter, he's only practically hysterical, like, "Get me out of here, get me out of here." And Arjuna just goes straight. And so finally, Arjuna says, "Here." And meanwhile, the Kurus are watching a single chariot coming straight for them, driven by a lady in a dress with long braids. So then Uttara, who obviously, I mean, Uttara is hysterical with fright. So Arjuna puts him as a chariot driver, and Arjuna says, "I'll take care of this." Anyway, at a certain point, he took his dress off. And everyone realized that this is Arjuna, and they immediately start calculating, like, "Oh my God, 1 year, and what day is today?" And so they realize that, you know, it's just about the time. So Arjuna goes there, and for 1 year, he has like 13 or 14 years of this pent up anger, and he's just like, I mean, he was Arjuna to start with, but now 14 years, 13 years of this pent up frustration, anger, and he just basically completely overwhelms the Kurus. He just single handedly just overwhelms the Kurus. No one can get near him, no one can fight with him, and he drives them away. And at that point, it's just like when the Pandavas came out of hiding at the Swayamvara of Draupadi, it was a crisis for the Kurus. Now, perhaps even more so, because the year is up. The Pandavas completed their vow. They want their kingdom back, and their attitude is different. It's not the old Pandavas. Now they're hardened, they're angry, they don't have any qualms about, you know, and they want their kingdom or they want war. And so, anyway, at that point, there's a book of the Mahabharata which describes all these different efforts at diplomacy to avoid the war. And interestingly, people that only know the Bhagavad Gita often ask, like, "Well, this is a spiritual book. Why is Krishna encouraging Arjuna to fight?" And of course, the answer which I often give is that the system of government that we can observe in that ancient time is what we would call constitutional monarchy. Constitutional monarchy, in which, just if you think of the Magna Carta of England, it's not absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy is something which basically really became popular in the 1600s in Europe, and you know, the great example is Louis XIV, l'état c'est moi. And it led to the French Revolution. It led to the end of monarchy, because absolute monarchy, being sort of overreaching, absolute monarchy was oppressive, and it led to the collapse of monarchy. And so, previous to that, there was more of a constitutional monarchy. And in fact, if you look at the history of the Mughal Empire in India, Aurangzeb was kind of like one of the great villains of history, became an absolutist monarch. He basically suspended all of the agreements and conciliatory arrangements that had been made by previous Mughals with the Hindu majority Hindu population. Akbar, of course, was very enthusiastic about Vedic culture. And they'd reached all these accommodations, all these, you know, sort of agreements and how they could live together and so on. And Aurangzeb was basically a religious fanatic, and he suspended all of that. He spent his entire, very long reign for many decades just attacking other kingdoms, and he was always at war, he was against everyone, and he wanted to basically just sort of stamp out every other religion as far as possible. And the result of this is that soon after Aurangzeb, the Mughal Empire collapsed. So you can see it in Europe, you can see it in the Mughals, you can see it many places, that if you get too heavy, just like in relationships, someone that tries too much to control another person often destroys the relationship. And so, anyway, this was a constitutional monarchy which Duryodhana had violated. In most parts of the world, in most countries, someone suspending the constitution, usurping the government, would be considered reasonable grounds for armed opposition. And that was actually the case. Apart from the whole issue of the Asura invasion. In other words, it was there were grounds which almost any reasonable person would consider to be sufficient for forceful opposition. So, anyway, a battle was looming. The Pandavas claimed their half of the kingdom. In other words, after all they'd undergone, they weren't even going to attack Duryodhana. They didn't want Hastinapur. They simply said, give us back what is rightfully ours. And Duryodhana refused. Duryodhana refused because he was an Asura and he really didn't care about the rules. That's one of the main definitions of Asura. Of an Asura, one who doesn't care about the rules, one who doesn't care about Dharma. Ultimately, he had no interest in Dharma, and by this time he just wanted to hold on to power. And there's a famous statement he made, a very famous statement, where his advisors, Bhishma, Drona, they're all advising him, make peace with the Pandavas, don't fight them. And give them back their land. And Duryodhana says, I will not give them enough land to put a pin, isn't it? I will not give them enough land even to stick a pin. In other words, nothing. The Pandavas, so again, I was saying about Krishna. Krishna himself was a leading figure in trying to avoid the battle. So if you just read the Bhagavad Gita, you see Krishna encouraging Arjuna to fight, but Krishna, before this war, himself was a leading figure in the diplomacy trying to avoid the war. And in fact, the Pandavas at one point said, look, we are Kshatriyas. It is our dharma to rule. And if we don't act as Kshatriyas, we can't follow our dharma. Therefore, give us 5 villages. We'll rule 5 villages. And Duryodhana said, no. That's when he said, no, not enough land to stick a pin. And so there were many attempts at diplomacy, Vidura. Finally, Krishna himself came to Hastinapur as an ambassador trying to make peace. And all the sane people in Hastinapur welcomed him and recognized who he was. But Duryodhana and Karna, again, poor Karna, who's always misunderstood and really was, you know, a great guy. Duryodhana and Karna actually try to arrest Krishna. They have a plan, and he's an ambassador. I mean, even today, according to modern law, that's criminal behavior to try to arrest an ambassador that's come in peace. And Krishna is trying so hard. Krishna is trying so hard to avoid the war that he even reveals a bit of his Virat Rupa, that cosmic form, before the people there, Karna, Duryodhana, and so on, to show them that, look, you're not going to win this war. So he sort of gave them a calling card by showing them this. But Duryodhana, by that time, was so insane with his personal ambition, anger, and demonic qualities, he thought, oh, you know, it's just something a magician does. It's almost like a reverse of that famous scene in the Old Testament where Moses, it's actually a similar thing where Moses comes before the Pharaoh and says, let my people go. And then he throws down his staff and it becomes a serpent. And the Pharaoh thinks, cheap magic. And then he calls his own magicians to make serpents. And so it's almost a scene like that where Duryodhana and Karna think this is, well, Duryodhana thinks this is just magic, you know. He doesn't understand that this is really Krishna. So all these attempts fail. All these attempts fail, and there's going to be war. And so the next part of the Mahabharata, again, for the Pandava side, first of all, fighting to save the world from the Asuras, and even from a human point of view, fighting to restore government by Dharma. The word Dharma also means law. And so you find throughout this culture, throughout the story, that people cite Dharma exactly as in modern times we would cite the law. They cite Dharma, that this is Dharma or it's not Dharma. So it's very much a consciousness of living according to an objective set of laws, as opposed to absolute monarchy where the king just, you know, off with their heads, just does whatever the king wants. So the next stage is a sort of this very, how should I put it, intense, all these intense efforts on both sides to secure allies. And because there are a certain number of great kingdoms in that part of the world, and so the Pandavas and Duryodhana are doing everything possible to secure allies. Ultimately, 18 great armies. The Sanskrit word is Akshohini. An Akshohini was sort of a full army that consists of thousands of infantry and so many chariots and cavalrymen and so on and so forth, elephants. So a full, a complete Vedic army or just army from that time was called an Akshohini. And it said that in this battle there were 18 Akshoginis. The battle lasted 18 days. There's 18 books of the Mahabharata, so it's the story of 18. So anyway, so 18 great armies came to Kurukshetra. And of those, 11 sided with Duryodhana and 7 with the Pandavas. So that's why in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, when Duryodhana goes to Drona, just to make sure, because Drona was very affectionate toward the Pandavas, Arjuna had been his favorite student, and Bhishma had raised the Pandavas. So there were very, very strong emotional ties between Bhishma and Drona and the Pandavas, and Duryodhana went to Drona. Trishwa tu pandavanikam bhyudham Duryodhana tada acharyam pasangamya raja vachanam abravit. So Trishwa, however, seeing the great Pandava army assembled there in formation, Duryodhana went to his acharya, went to his teacher, approaching his teacher, spoke these words. And then Duryodhana sort of simultaneously bragging about their own power, apariyatam tadasmakam balam bhishma virakshitam. Our forces are unlimited, protected by Bhishma, whereas their forces are limited. So at this point, when the two armies are assembled, and Krishna has agreed that Krishna won't personally fight, but he will drive Arjuna's chariot. In fact, so at that point, the Bhagavad Gita begins. We're actually at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. And Arjuna looks upon these armies, and of course, not only are Bhishma and Drona mostly attached to him, but Arjuna is also attached to them. He sees his guru. And, I mean, you imagine back then, there was this extremely, very strong guru-disciple culture. So here he's looking upon his guru. He's looking upon Bhishma, who practically raised him as a child when he lost his father. And he knows, and Nakula and Sahadev, the twins, are looking at their uncle. Shalya, the brother of their mother, of their departed mother, is fighting for Duryodhana. Because basically, as he admits later in the story, he's been bribed. And he's fighting against them, their uncle. So here they. So it's. If you think of the American Civil War, often families were divided, especially near the border areas. And so Arjuna looks upon all these people that he's known all his life, his, you know, family, guru, and this is what he says. And so at this point, the Bhagavad Gita begins. And Arjuna has an unprecedented, not loss of nerve, he wasn't afraid, but he, and this was always an issue, because again, I'll make this last point I'll make, and then tonight I guess we'll talk about the Bhagavad Gita, and then the end of the story. The Pandavas were raised as Brahmins, as yogis, and so if you think of it, a great sage, a yogi, a Brahmin, their tendency is just to tolerate. In fact, that's one of the main teachings to a yogi, is that just don't be attached to things in this world. Just be tolerant, be equipoised, avoid the dualities of attachment and hatred, don't worry about victory and defeat, and so on and so forth. And so there was always this sort of little undertow in the minds of the Pandavas, like, why are we doing all this? Why are we fighting like this? And of course, it was Krishna's mission. They had to do it. The world was at stake, but personally, in terms of their own emotions, many of the Pandavas, not Bhima, but many of the other Pandavas really thought, personally, I don't care. Personally, I don't even want a kingdom. And so it was this emotion that was always present in the Pandavas because of who they were, because they were great souls, they were actually enlightened yogis, and they were friends of Krishna. So as Arjuna looked upon the battlefield, he sort of suddenly, that feeling, which was, had always been there, but had always been subordinated to their dharma, their duty, the need to protect the world, suddenly just overwhelmed Arjuna, these emotions. And that's when he put down his bow and told Krishna, I can't do this. So, we'll conclude this evening. Thank you very much.